some themes within the Bible. We're doing this kind of crazy thing that we do every couple of years, and that is we're taking you through the DNA of the Bible on the most macro level possible. And so what we're doing is we're reminding you over and over again that there are kind of two primary themes that we see in the Scriptures. And those two themes you can actually trace down to two words theologically. They're called covenant and kingdom. But what they're really about is being with God and doing for God and along with God. They're about what we often call relationship on one side and responsibility on the other side, or identity on the one side and action on the other side. So when you look at the Scriptures and the story, what you see over and over again is you see God working with people and revealing something about the nature of who their identity is in God, or the nature of what their calling is as people of God. And so you see this growing and growing and growing till it finds ultimate clarity in Jesus. Okay? And so we haven't gotten to that part yet. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Abraham and how God formed a covenant with Abraham and what that looked like, both in the gruesome details of cutting a covenant. If you remember, we sawed a horse in half. But also what it meant to be blessed in order to be a blessing, not as God's spoiled little brats, but as representatives of the God of love for all nations. Okay? And then last week, Dwayne talked us through the story of Joseph, which is primarily a story about kingdom representation. So what does it look like to be moving from Joseph's journey of kind of self-importance all the way to understanding that it's actually not about him, it's about God. And it's about God using him. And so this week, we go on to a third character that is crucial for so many reasons in the Old Testament narrative. And he's known primarily for four main words by maybe the greater culture. It's these four words.
That might be Bordeaux.
Yeah, so this is the child of a pastor and an actor. Finds themselves in many unique situations in the costume closet. And so this was 6 years ago, my son, and it's just so good. I saw him dressing up, and I said, you know what would complete this moment was if you'd just repeat a phrase for me, Judah. And so he said,
Debt my people do.
Yes, debt my people do is really spoken with true power and authority. But there was so much that happened in this story before the let my people go moment of Moses. And so we want to understand what was going on there before we can actually get there. So Moses' story is a story of somebody having no idea who they are and therefore no idea what it looks like to live into a calling of any sort. Okay? We'll get rid of my son's face there. The goal within this whole thing is to help you, on one respect, understand how to look at the Scriptures and give you a rubric and a framework for how to engage as you read the Bible. And the second purpose is just to help you understand this big story. So sometimes when you give messages, it's all about, like, here's what you have to do. Here's the principles and the applications. That's not a great reading of the Bible frequently. There's certainly plenty of principles, plenty of applications to pull from. However, sometimes we have to step back and just let the story speak. Because the story is what forms us. How we see people engaging and struggling with God and how God's understood and represented as time changes and as God's people change. And so we're just going to go through this story. We've been through 50 chapters of Genesis in the last 2 weeks. So we're only doing 20 this week of Exodus. So you're great. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not. But don't get nervous because then it won't go well for you. But before the let my people go moment, you have to understand that Moses didn't have an understanding of what my people even meant. Okay. So after the time of Joseph, we get this right off the bat in Exodus 1. After the time of Joseph, Here's what happened. Joseph and all of his brothers in that generation, remember, Joseph had risen to prominence in Egypt among the leadership However, they don't have like great ways of, you know, taking pictures and putting them on the wall or going back and looking at Facebook posts to say, oh, that's right, Joseph was this great leader and he was a Hebrew. So instead, he's forgotten as the generations pass. It's forgotten that Joseph was once significant in the story of Egypt. And the generations pass, but the Israelites continue to grow, and they become quite a powerful group of people, potentially. They're a powerful workforce, though, according to the Egyptians, when they look at them. And so here's what happens. Now, Joseph and all of his brothers in that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came into power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. There are little hints throughout the story of Exodus that readers of the Gospels later are supposed to notice and go back to. And that's one. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the fields, and their hard labor, in all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Okay, I'm not going to keep reading because 20 chapters takes a long time. So here's what happens after that. So the Pharaoh takes a look at everything going on. He says, this is still not working. They're still becoming too numerous. And so he goes and he finds the Hebrew midwives and he tells them, listen, we need to cut off the generation. So as you help the Hebrew women give birth, if it's a male, I want you to kill them. And you're going to say that it was a miscarriage. Okay, and so he orders them upon strict penalty to do this. However, they're not going to do that. They're not going to betray their own people. So what they do is they let them live. And Pharaoh comes back and says, what are you doing? This isn't working. And they said, these women are so strong and robust. They're not like Egyptian women. It's like a little jab to the Egyptian. They're not like the Egyptian women. These women are strong. And they give birth before we even get there. And so we can't pull this off. And so he gets more and more upset and finally makes a decree across the land. And we don't know how broadly this was shared, but that every child under two is killed. Once again, is that reminiscent of another story? Herod, the birth of Jesus, everyone under two killed in a strange land. And so here's the story that we have, and it's a foreshadowing of something that would happen later that was incredibly powerful, but we're not supposed to miss that. So in the midst of this, one of the Hebrew mothers gives birth and then hides her child for 3 months. And eventually she can't hide him anymore. And so these babies are actually supposed to be thrown into the river. That's what we're told the decree was. But she puts her son, this is obviously going to be the story of Moses, puts her son in a basket and puts tar on the bottom of the basket, makes it waterproof, and with a prayer sends it down the Nile. Okay. Now the river goes by Pharaoh's palace. And one of Pharaoh's daughters is out there and sees this baby coming by. And she sees it and she claims it. And she decides to raise it as her own in the Pharaoh's complex. Now you look at that and say, well, why didn't she just kill it? Did she know about the decree? Yes, 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 but here's the deal. Egyptians were incredibly spiritual people. And the pantheon of the gods was very strong. And the god of fertility, the mother god, was named Isis. And it was manifested by the life of the Nile. And so the river, which is representation of the female deity, is giving a child to this princess, or whatever we want to call her. So she sees it, and she sees it, most likely. Maybe she's just compassionate. We're not told this. We're inferring it because of cultural understanding and context. She sees it as a gift from the gods. And so she takes Moses in, and she says, I need a Hebrew midwife to nurse him, and so actually finds Moses' mom. And she's like, I'll do it. And so she raises him. How about this? And she gets paid to raise her own child. It's a good gig, right? Not really, because she has to give her child up then. And so Moses is raised in the royal family and gets older. And at the same time, all this time, he knows he's a Hebrew. He looks different. So he might be raised with all of the privileges and the blessings of the palace life, but he understands that that's not actually who he is, or at least he has some inkling that this isn't fully who I am. There's a part of my identity that's yet to be figured out. And so he does understand that he is Hebrew, because as the time goes by and as he becomes kind of a young adult, he notices the oppression of the people that share his lineage, although he doesn't know a thing about his own lineage, because he left too early. And so one day, he's out there, and he's apparently been learning more and more and more about these people, because at least in some way, whether or not he's learning, he's feeling a connection to them. And he sees them being mistreated. And he sees that the Egyptians are beating them and harassing them and enslaving. And in an act of anger and righteous anger, he gets super upset, and then he does something awful. He kills one of the Egyptian guards that is beating a Hebrew slave. And then he buries him. And he thinks nobody really saw it. But the next day he's back out, and one of the Israelites, who's not a big fan of Moses, apparently, jaws at him and says, "What, are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian guard?" And Moses says, "Oh my goodness, apparently the word's gotten out." Pharaoh finds out. Pharaoh comes after him wanting to kill him. And Moses takes off, and he flees into the desert. So, this is crucial. He flees into the desert, and this is where we get to the real story. Moses goes from this golden child to a man without a name, and a man without a land, and a man without a people, okay? It's really fascinating to look at people of influence in the scriptures because there is a consistent storyline. And the storyline of people who are able to be used in a powerful way by God, there's this movement, and the movement looks like this. Blessed, broken, and then used. And you'll see it happening over and over and over again in the life of people who are finally able to be used by God in powerful ways. There's a blessed, broken, and used in almost everything. And usually there's a blessing that's some sort of a physical, you know, grown up in the right way, something they didn't deserve. Joseph, right, he gets the coat of many colors. He gets the long sleeves that say, you don't have to work. You're going to be over all of your brothers. And then some brokenness happens. And in that brokenness, there is something that brings people to a point of learning who the nature of God truly is. And then they are blessed in order to be a blessing to other people. So you see this over and over and over again. So Moses has a bit of a Joseph experience here, right? Once having it all, now having nothing, he's broken and he heads off into the desert and begins an entirely new life. He finds a wife. He cares for her father's sheep. He's living among the land of the Midianites, okay? A different people group completely. All right? This is a major career shift. He once owned the land that he is now wandering through, not even owning the sheep he's taking care of. Okay? Who he is, we get a sense that he's not quite sure of. But yet, there's something there that's going on. And so, in chapter 3, we find Moses going to the far side of the desert and embracing the desert experience fully, running from the past. And the desert is what the desert always is in the Bible. So, always in the Bible, the desert, not dessert, I know how to spell it now. Oops. The desert equals a place of desperation and dependence, okay? So once again, we're just doing some Bible competency. Dependence. A-E-E. Dependence, yes. I can spell really good when I'm not on a whiteboard. So anytime someone experiences a desert, we still do this, right? A desert experience. We talk about a desert experience. We get it from the biblical imagery, where the experiences of people in the desert are a time of desperation. They're a time of being forced into dependence on God. We're going to see this mirrored next week when we talk about Jesus, because Jesus goes into the desert where his own identity is called into question. And so desert equals desperation and dependence. And in the midst of the desert, he finds a mountain. And mountains in the Bible, man, I'm really, really bad. Is that right? Okay, thanks. Just yell it out if it's wrong. Mountains are places of meeting. So mountains are places of meeting with God. A mountaintop experience, yes? You understand this. It's coming from our language, from the biblical stories. Jesus withdraws to mountains, to hillsides, to be still and meet with God. Mountains are places of meeting. So in the midst of the desert, we find that Moses encounters a mountain. You can't make this stuff up. The imagery is wonderful. Jesus, there's so many great parallels here, but that's not what we're talking about. So Moses gets to the mountain, and it's where he meets God in what else? Fire. This is going to be a recurring theme, again, for God's presence. He sees a bush that's burning, but not burning up. As strange as it is to us, seeing a burning bush would not be the most radical thing in the desert, because there were plenty of bushes that needed combustion through fire in order to germinate. So there would be fires that broke out. However, something is very unique about this one. And what's unique about this one is that the leaves are still there and the branches aren't actually being consumed. And so he's curious and he follows it up. And when he gets there, he hears a voice that says, "Don't come any closer, for the place you're standing on is holy ground." He says, "I knew I shouldn't have gone toward the light." It's told, "Remove your shoes, Moses." And Moses has no idea what's going on. And here's where it gets powerful, because this is the first time he has ever heard the voice of God. We kind of think that Moses had some framework for all of this, but he didn't. Moses is on the far side of the desert having no idea who he is, okay? All right. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, he said from the bush, "Moses, Moses," and Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place that you're standing is holy ground." Then he said, listen to this, for a man without an identity, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. It's a very interesting phrase that Moses hid his face at that moment. I often wonder if the reason Moses hid his face and turned away is because not just of fear, but maybe because something in his past is being unearthed. And it's difficult to face something that's in your past. An identity that you've never known. A personal word. "I'm the God of your father." The first thing God does is he speaks a word of identity. So here's a guy who's not an Egyptian. He's certainly not a Midianite. And maybe he's an Israelite by birth, but not in any other way. He doesn't know who he is. The guy just a few years earlier had a son and he named him Gershom, which means "I am an alien in a foreign land." Like, can you imagine that kid at like social gatherings? "Yeah, dad was having a rough day." Right? You name your kid "I am an alien in a foreign land." That is brutal. But outside of that, we see Moses is in the middle of a midlife crisis. He has no idea who he really is, but God speaks to him about this covenant. So God says essentially, "Hey, you're mine, by the way. I am the God of your family." Moses has no family. And God says, "Actually, you have a rich identity as my child." Okay, so that's where God's starting point is. Remember how we say all of our actions always have to flow as Christ followers, have to flow out of our identity. Otherwise, they become hollow. Okay, so the first thing God speaks to Moses is about identity. All right, and now God gives him identity. And when he gives him that, he's actually talking about protection and provision because of what a covenant meant. And eventually, it'll form the foundation for Moses' ability to speak with authority and move in the power of the kingdom. Okay? All right. By the way, don't we need God, just take a pause from the story here, don't we need God to constantly be reminding us of these sorts of things? "You're mine." I love that he says that he self-identifies, "I am your God." Instead of, "Hey, you're one of my people," but "I am your God." God is making the statement about himself. "I've chosen to be your God, the God of your fathers." It's this beautiful, "And I have heard the cry of my people," God says, not the people, but my people. "I am their God because I have a covenant with them and I will stay faithful to them. And out of that covenant, Moses, I'm sending you to let my people go, to do the work of the kingdom." And Moses, who is now completely secure in his identity, says, "You are on. Let me grab my rifle. I am on the way." Not at all. No, no, Moses has a complete meltdown with all of this stuff. And this is where it gets really kind of fun. So Moses gives quite a response. Here's five different times God tries to reassure him that he's calling him, and five different times Moses comes up with excuses of why he's a poor candidate for this mission. Okay? So the first one, Moses says, "Who am I that you would want to do anything with me, that I would somehow be able to speak to Pharaoh and free these people?" Right? "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God's response here is, "I will be with you. I will be with you." It's pretty simple. That's why "who am I" can be overcome, because I'll be with you. Secondly, he quickly says, "But I've still got big questions about you, God." He says, "What if they ask who sent me? I don't even know what to tell them. I don't even know your name." By the way, nobody does yet. We're about to get a huge moment, because the name of God is incredibly crucial in the story, in the whole story. So God self-identifies, and he says, "If you've got questions, okay, I'll supply what you need. Tell them that I am has sent you." And Moses is like, "Well, that's not helpful at all. What kind of a name is that?" So the word Yahweh, okay, in Hebrew is a descriptor word. And here's why this is so important. Yahweh means "I am that I am," or "I am who I am," or "I will be who I will be." It's a very interesting name, okay? It certainly signifies presence. I am the present. I am the God who is ever present, okay? But here's what a lot of Hebrew scholars think, and theologians, as they're looking at this, that all the other gods, like Ra, the sun god, and Isis, the Nile god, or the female deity, and all of these kind of subdivisions of gods that would inhabit reptiles and birds and all these other things in the pantheon of the Egyptians, they all had certain responsibilities of what they oversaw. I oversee the sky. I oversee fertility. I oversee this and this. And God's name is not God of the sun. It's "I will be who I will be." And a lot of theologians think that that actually means that God is self-identifying, refusing to be put into any category, and saying, "I will be for my people exactly who I need them to be, or who they need me to be." So you see God as comforter. You see God as prophet and judge sometimes. You see God as rescuer and redeemer. And you see God wearing all of these different responsibilities and roles with his people throughout time, because God will be whoever his people really need him to be. He links his identity with his people, not with a certain responsibility that's disconnected to them. So this is an enormous moment when he speaks of his name and self-identifies as Yahweh. But what he's really saying was, "I will be with you. I'll supply you what you need. I'll tell you what you need to know." This is in 3:13. "Suppose I go to them and say, 'The God of your fathers has sent me,' and they ask me, 'What's his name? What should I tell him?'" And then he goes into this long response of like, "Here's what you're supposed to do. Here's what you'll tell them. Don't worry, I'll be with you. They'll do it. They'll understand." And in chapter 4 at the beginning, Moses says, "Oh, but what if they don't? They won't listen." God's just given like this 5-paragraph narrative of how he will be with him the whole time. But Moses answered, "What if they don't believe me or listen to me and say, 'The Lord did not appear to you?'" And the Lord keeps up with him. If I was Yahweh, I would have been like, "Dude, you are done. I will go and find somebody else gladly. This is driving me crazy." And instead, what God says is, "I'll help with that." And he says, "Pick up your staff and throw it on the ground. If you don't think they'll listen, throw it on the ground." And he does, and it becomes a snake, and Moses screams and runs away. "Go back and pick it up, Moses." All right, so he goes there, and I can relate. I had a crazy wildlife experience last week, and some of you know this. And he picks it up, and it becomes a staff again. And then he shows him that he can make his hand leprous and heal it. And so he's saying, "I will give you signs that will help them understand that I have sent you. I'm going to be with you through this, Moses." Okay. And so finally, Moses says, oh, it's all good. No, he says, I'm not skilled enough, though. I'm not good with my voice and with speaking. I'm a bad public speaker, God. You picked the wrong person. And God, in an ever-present sense of patience, when he says, I've not been eloquent neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. So in other words, can't you see in the last 5 minutes I'm not really doing well here? You know, and God says, hold on. Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Isn't it me? This is what Yahweh says back. Like, don't you think I can work with this? Don't you think I can work with you? Have you forgotten that I'm going to be with you? I made you. I'll be with you. And finally, Moses, completely out of excuses, says, okay, you got it, God. Nope, 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 he does not. He says, really, I just don't want to. Because he's got nothing left. God's solved every one of his crises moments. But Moses said, oh, Lord, please just send someone else to do it. Really, I just don't want to. And of course, God says, really, you're still going to. And I will be with you. And of course, he supplies his brother Aaron. And he says, if you don't think you can handle this, I'll show you that you can. But you can use Aaron. I'll use you guys as a tag team. He will be like your voice. And he can actually do some of the speaking to Pharaoh. So this is the crazy thing. So by the way, Moses here, this is important. Moses here is not showing a humble attitude. Okay? Sometimes we look at this and say, he's just humble. He knew he wasn't good enough. No. Here's what happens. Yeah, okay. So what we have frequently is we have two different things that can distract us from connecting with the identity of who God has called us to be. So what we saw in Joseph was we saw this world of self-importance. Okay? So this was Joseph. Joseph had to learn from God that his self-importance must die. Okay? Moses is consumed with self-doubt. Okay? This is Moses. He's consumed with his self-doubt, and he has to learn that self-doubt must die. Because most of us, I don't know if you feel the same way, but most of us, I think, spend a life that is often characterized by the roller coaster journey of self-importance to self-doubt. It's all about me, or I'm never good enough to do anything good. And so this journey between oscillating between self-importance and self-doubt forms the foundation of a lack of healthy identity with God. So up here, if you're too self-important, you'll never understand that it's actually not you, that you're not going to be able to accomplish meaningful things on your own strength. It's God's strength working through you for the actual kingdom things. If it's too much about you, you will get in the way and it will never happen. God will never be able to use you if your job and your hope is self-advancement and if your ego is up front. It's what we read about in our call to worship, right? Jesus, even though Jesus was in very nature God, chose humility as the healthy expression of what love looks like, of what power looks like even, of what influence looks like. But on the flip side here, Moses has to understand that self-doubt is the other paralyzing force in finding identity. Neither of these are finding identity in God. And so until that happens, until you actually find identity in God, apart from self-importance and apart from self-doubt, you're not going to be able to actually be a representative of God's kingdom with God's strength. You'll either have no strength or you'll have your strength. But neither of those things trusts God. Okay? And so this understanding is fairly crucial, that if we want to represent God's kingdom by God's strength, we have to understand that these are both kind of ditches that we need to not fall into. And Moses falls into the one. Let's keep going on. I think they're probably going to play a lot of music with the kids there. They had some very exciting plans today. So why don't you, thanks, Cammie. That'll help us. Or maybe just me, but it'll help. So before we go on, we need to just acknowledge that Moses in this moment would have been happy, probably, to simply dwell in this covenant identity. I am the God of your fathers. you're mine, I love you. And Moses would probably be okay with saying, yeah, that's great, I have an identity now, I know who I am. But God does not let that happen. God says, listen, part of this identity, and Dwayne explained this last week, God is Father, and that gives us our sense of identity. But our Father also happens to be King, and that requires a sense of representation in the world, of revealing who our Father and who our King actually is. And so he says, I need you to go and do something. This is a part of the deal. This is a part of the identity. We don't just sit here in a lovey-dovey relationship between us and God. We work out of that identity for compassion, for justice, for reconciliation. And it's powerful and it's important. So, on Moses goes to confront the kingdom of the new Pharaoh, who does not remember Moses by this point. Okay? And if that's hard for you to believe, there wasn't exactly like, it wasn't like Moses grew up with Pharaoh as his dad. It wasn't that kind of a world. He may have grown up as a prince of Egypt, as the movie explains. However, in this world, there was plenty of separation in the royal family, especially someone who was adopted in, to be honest. And so everybody was a threat to pharaohs. And so the fact that this new pharaoh, whether probably one of the brother types of Moses at one point, may not have ever even known him. There were plenty of people growing up in the palace in that kind of a world. But he comes in, and this is where it gets interesting. I already mentioned that Egypt was built on the pantheon of gods, okay? And so when we get into the world of what we call the 10 plagues, often, we struggle with how to understand them as just like God showing power, okay? God kind of messing with the Egyptians and showing them that he was better. Okay, but this is actually a spiritual battle completely. So the goal here of the 10 plagues, of what happens when Moses goes to Pharaoh and he says, listen, God has spoken to me. I want you to release the Israelites so that they can go and worship me, worship Yahweh in the desert. And Pharaoh says, no, I can't afford that loss of workforce. And Moses says, you're oppressing my people. You need to do this or else God's mighty hand will be made known to you. And he says, I don't know your God. I don't know this Yahweh. And I certainly have no respect for your people. And so what ends up happening is a clash of kingdoms. And so what we see is the power of Egypt was built on a collection of different gods and angelic beings, but they all basically came out of an extrapolation of human sexuality. Okay, so there's a male and female components to their spiritual infrastructure, and the male deity and the female deity dwell together. And the female deity is Isis, like I said, embodied through the actions of the Nile. And the male deity is Ra, who is the god of the sky and the sun. So Moses says, let my people go. Pharaoh says, no. So Moses, with Aaron, takes his staff and he strikes the water of the Nile. And the female deity, the source of life for Egypt, begins to die. Okay? So understand this. All the creatures within her then begin to die too, and all the animals connected to her begin to rebel. The gods of Egypt are frequently displayed in animal forms, like reptiles or insects, according to hieroglyphics that we have. Because the reptiles are associated with Isis, the Nile female god, and insects are connected to Ra, the sky god, the male deity. So in the plagues that occur, God is systematically dismantling the spiritual world of the Egyptians, as Pharaoh refuses to relinquish control in the enslavement of the Hebrews. So this is what's happening. So the early plagues are all connected with water and land, and the later ones are all connected with the air and the sky. Hail and locusts carried by the wind. So there is a systematic element of this that we sometimes breeze over and don't quite know how to understand. This is about God helping people see that the false gods didn't have power. This was not about God ripping the Egyptians. Okay, sometimes we try to put that framework on it, and it's simply not helpful for an ancient document in the scriptures and what the scriptures are actually trying to reveal. Okay? Each time Pharaoh begins to soften his heart, he hardens it again. It's quite terrifying, and the hardness of heart finally brings Egypt to a point of terrible loss when Moses confronts the final spiritual stronghold and says, God's going to take the incarnation of your gods. The names of Pharaoh always meant son of one of the gods, okay? So Ramesses was son of Ra, And it was understood that the spirit of their deity actually rested with the Pharaoh and the Pharaoh's firstborn son. Okay? And so then in this last terrifying and very, very brutal act to read, it's discomforting to read a story of death. But this angel of death passes through the land, and Moses instructs his people to share a lamb meal and take the blood of the lamb and put it on the doorway, making a corridor, literally a corridor of blood, reminding them of that the cutting of the covenant that happened once before with Abraham. And also, interestingly, as they're doing this, they're making a sign of cross. Just once again, just fascinating little elements of the story here. But as they do this, the Spirit passes through them, and the Israelites are spared, and the firstborn of animals and people in Egypt are not. And so this brings a point of complete brokenness. But this is, once again, God's judgment of the gods of Egypt. It says that really clearly in Exodus 12:12. Okay? Clearly God's judgment of the gods of Egypt. And it's terrible, and it's an incredible story. And the Egyptians are freed from captivity, and they're led on an exodus into the desert. They leave the land of Egypt with their neighbors giving them all the silver and gold they had to the Hebrews because they just want them to get out now. And those materials were then used for this temporary temple in the desert. So, I'm going to zip through this. One more thing to mention, because I know that these weeks are wild because we're giving you a lot of information to take in, but let's talk about the Red Sea. So they're journeying out of Egypt, and God brings them to the edge of the Red Sea, okay? And in what's happening, here's what you read in Moses, chapter 14 now, okay? He's secure in his identity. Up until this point, he's still been struggling, and he's been getting progressively more confident in who he is. And here's the thing. They get out to the Red Sea, and they see that Pharaoh changes his mind, and they're pursuing him. And all of the people start to freak out and say, really, Moses? Were there not enough graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to die? Is that the story now? He said, didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die in the desert. And here's what Moses answers to the people. Do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. There's a couple of interesting things happening there. But he has such trust from his identity with God in covenant that he is able to proclaim with confidence, God is with us. Stop thinking that that you can't do anything. Because you don't need to do anything. Just simply be still. And God speaks then at that point to Moses, take your staff and put it in the water and walk across dry land. And of course, they do. And the sea closes in on the Egyptians. Notice the change in Moses from, I can't do it, but it's not about you, God says. And then he starts to learn. This is a new type of leadership and authority that Moses uses. It's a movement for him. So there's a great celebration after this. And here's the fascinating thing. Let's go all the way to Exodus 19 now as we wrap up kind of the direct elements of the story. And in Exodus 19, in verse 4, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and says, this is what you're to say to the house of Jacob. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possessions. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay, I'm going to read that statement one more time. Now, he speaks, he says, remember, I'm your God. I am in covenant with you. I have formed this relationship with you. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, we read that often like commandment. Like, if you follow all the rules, I won't destroy you. Okay? That is an untrue reading of what a covenant is. A covenant is not a contract. A covenant is an identity that is founded on relationship. And so when he says this, this is what you're supposed to say. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, that means if you maintain your relational foundation in me. My people, if you maintain your relational foundation, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. That doesn't mean, it means if you live in connection with relationship, then you will experience the goodness that emerges out of relational connection with me. And then, out of that covenant, he says, and I'll make you a kingdom of priests. Once again, that all means, and I will enable you to represent me fully. That's what priests did. They represented God to the people. So he said, I will enable you to be a whole kingdom of priests, that one day you will go out and everyone will understand the nature of who I am. And Jesus then reveals that in the clearest and most obvious ways. Compassion, love, forgiveness, grace, mercy, over and over and over and over again. So God continues to work with them, but as the time comes, so he gives them the Ten Commandments briefly after that, and the Ten Commandments, the first four are about, or the first six are about identity, covenant, the relationship, and the next four are about kingdom, how they represent God in the external world, and so you get this over and over still coming, but unfortunately, what they start doing is obedience without identity, and that's the rest of the Old Testament. So God's people, they try to follow the rules, but they lose the identity of who they really are, and that becomes tyranny really quickly. That becomes legalism really quickly, and it's still going when we get to the time of Jesus. And so you look at Jesus disobeying a bunch of the rules about Sabbath and talking to the Pharisees about how they'd lost the way because they didn't have any relational foundation with God in the same covenantal kind of a way that they were intended to. So they were making these rules, and it was becoming completely oppressive. And so Jesus addresses that, and he challenges them to move out from that. So, what do we do with all this? Here's one takeaway. I want you to think about this, hopefully, but I also want you to think about one more takeaway, and that is that God wants to use our weakness to show and reveal his glory. God wants to use our weakness to show and reveal his glory. These are hard to sit with a story like this and understand what maybe personal implications are. And I'm always sensitive as Jesus followers for us to just pull a story from the Old Testament and if it's not fully informed by Jesus, just say, well, this means you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And that's how we've gotten into all sorts of holy wars and all kinds of other problems. And so that's not correct. However, what we see over and over is God saying, trust me in your weaknesses. I'll keep working with you even when you break your end of the covenant. And we're going to keep going, and we're going to keep doing this, and we're going to continue to build a foundation of relationship that is actually founded mainly on your weakness. And so if you feel weak a lot, and I don't know where that comes, I don't know where your Moses moment comes out where you say, yeah, I'm not blank. What's your weakness? Do you feel like it's your gender? Do you feel like it's your life stage? Your skill set, your financial status, maybe. Maybe you have a physical impairment that limits what you think God can use you for. Maybe there's a past history in your life. Maybe there's a struggle that is ongoing. Maybe it's your age. Maybe you're too young or you're too old to be used by God. Those are all elements of people in the biblical narrative that had to figure out how to trust God. But maybe we need to bring those things to God so that we can hear that holy whisper of like, so what? That God loves to tell us in order to be used by God. Jesus intentionally seeks out the least qualified. We won't get into all this, but it's probably my favorite stuff. I'm a New Testament guy in terms of most of my work, so I know I skipped a bunch of stuff here. But when Jesus calls the disciples, they had all been through a Hebrew schooling system that had rejected them already. We're told that they're out fishing. That means by nature they had not been good enough to continue in the discipleship path of becoming a rabbi. And those are the ones he seeks out and says, come and follow me. It's this beautiful moment, lachacharai, is come and follow me. And they come immediately because Jesus saw something in them and gave them a chance that other people hadn't seen. We wonder why the disciples just leave and drop everything. And it wasn't because primarily Jesus had some magic words. It was that nobody had ever believed in them to actually go out and invite them to become a rabbi when they weren't good enough. So let that encourage you and challenge you. so that you don't lose sight of the fact that it's God's power that actually works through us to be people and agents of compassion and generosity and forgiveness and love and movement in the world, even with our kids, even with our parents, when we feel too weak to be able to lovingly be the influence of the kingdom toward them. It's God's strength that we rely on. We have about 2-3 comments, time for maybe. So we want to encourage you. We take a moment to just say, okay, is there anything that stirred in you? This was a big topic. Hopefully we didn't lose you too much. I know that we're just we're throwing a lot of information at you. That's intentional. We know it. As a church, we journey through a whole lot of different seasons. This one, we want to make sure that you're understanding the meta-narrative of the whole Bible. So let me pray for us and then take a moment to either ask a question or give a simple comment, and then we'll share communion and wrap up. Father, you come to us as Father and King. And that's a really difficult balance sometimes for us to learn how to respond to. It can make us feel incredibly important, so can our own ego. Or it can make us feel incredibly overwhelmed. And so I pray that you would speak your words, speak your name to us, like you did to Moses. I am, over and over again. I am, I am, I am, I will be with you. Allow that to stir us and transform us. Thank you for the clearest expression that we have in Jesus of an identity that is lived out in perfect kingdom representation of your heart. Thanks, God, for this time to lean into these challenges. Amen.